Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
In this bonus edition of the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, we're going to talk about a league that folded over 30 years ago and the passion of a group of people that is resurrecting a great project. Kyle Smith of the USFL Project is with us to talk about his group in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the dunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines and birthdays of Hall of Famers.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. For tonight, we have a bonus edition, and we're going to go back in time a little bit and talk about another professional football league that's not the NFL. It's the USFL, and talking with us is an expert on it, Kyle Smith, who is the executive director of the USFL Project, a long-term project that documents and preserves the history and stories of the United States Football League, leaving a foundation of knowledge for future generations. He's an award-winning journalist, and Smith has also spent 15 years in the entertainment industry, as well as being both a host and a guest on numerous radio shows and podcasts. In recent years, his attention has been focused on the USFL Project, with him and his team growing the group to over 4,000 members. Let's bring him in right now. Kyle Smith, welcome to the Pigpen.
Man, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here and taking the time to have me on. Thank you so much.
Well, we really appreciate your time coming on, because the USFL, I mean, that is an interesting subject. And, you know, we're glad to have an expert on here, because I remember I was a teenager when the USFL was out, and it was kind of an exciting time. Some forgotten memories because it's so long ago, and we're hoping maybe you can rekindle some of that and, you know, let us relive some of that passion from the USFL. But before we get into the USFL, why don't we learn a little bit more about you? How did you gain your passion for the game of football? Where may that come from?
I think it started for me at an early age, because I grew up in small town Oklahoma. So we all played backyard football. And then when we got the chance, the first chance I ever got to play organized football was in fifth grade. And it really just started from there. I always watched football on TV. I actually had a notebook when I was a kid, and I would create these matchups, like, you know, and I tried to pair teams together. I can remember one specifically, and this is really basic, but as a kid, I thought I was a genius. So I created the Battle of the Bays, and it was Tampa Bay versus Green Bay. And I drew the helmets and drew everything, you know, in that little notebook, and had my own little like point spread and the weather, because I was, you know, I was watching what was happening on TV. So yeah, I actually had a notebook that I would draw up these dream matchups that, you know, would actually happen, because Green Bay played Tampa Bay almost every year. But yeah, I would do that as a side hobby, but I played football as long as I could, which was, you know, through high school.
Getting in there, you said you grew the USFL Project in your bio to over 4,000 members. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the USFL Project is?
You know, the funny thing about the USFL Project is when I started it as a hobby. There was a show back on the East Coast probably 15 years ago, and I went and looked, and I noticed that a couple of the autograph guests were USFL alumni. And I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about the USFL in 100 years. And so I looked into it. I found a company that I don't think is in business anymore, but I found a company that actually had the USFL mini helmets. And I was like, you know, I want to do this. The USFL was such a big part of my childhood. So I can distinctly remember the two guests that were USFL alumni were Mike Rozier and Archie Griffin. And so I went to the website of this company. I bought a Pittsburgh Maulers mini helmet and I bought a Jacksonville Bulls mini helmet. And I shipped them off to the show. And when they came back and I opened the box, it was like I was reliving my childhood all over again. I sat and looked at those mini helmets and they were so beautifully done. And at that point, I decided to start the USFL project. And are you ready for this? The big conclusion to the USFL project, I wanted to get a mini helmet signed by one player from each of the 19 teams that were a part of the USFL. And that was going to be the conclusion of the USFL project. So I created this page. I showed off the helmets. As I started finding more alumni that were either doing shows or that I could actually find on Facebook, I started collecting a few more helmets, and then a few more helmets became a lot more helmets. And then I started looking, you know, through Google and seeing news stories about alumni and what they were doing now, or, you know, where are they now segments. And so I started posting those links on the page, and I just watched the numbers on the page grow. People were like gravitating to this, to the silly little page that I started to collect 19 mini helmets. And so at one point I decided to create a group. And I created the Facebook group and people just started joining like wildfire. We've probably accepted anywhere from 15 to 20 people today for a league that was 30 some odd years ago. and we have some incredible members that have ticket collections or have game programs or have memories. We had a guy. Subsequently, a team came along. So about a year ago, a gentleman by the name of Tom Cadle reached out to me and he said, "Hey man, I want to be a part of this. I want to do something. I want to be a part of this. This is what I live for." And so as Tom and I get to talking, Tom has been working on the USFL project from more of a statistical and data. And he's 15 or years more into this. And I was on the other side. So Tom and I talk. And I was like, "Tom, come on. I want you to be part of the team." And then Tom brings on a couple other guys, Jim Parcells out of Canada, who was a statistician for several different leagues. And if there's a stat out there, Jim's got it. And then he brings on Rob Butts, and Rob Butts has been a tremendous part of our team. Rob actually signed a contract to play for the Orlando Renegades in 1986, the season that didn't happen. And so he was going to be a part of the USFL had it not got caught up in litigation. But Rob's been an invaluable member to the team too. So in the span of a year, I've acquired a dream team. I've acquired these guys that are not only part of the USFL project, but these other contributors that are in our group daily that are posting these historical tickets or posters or pictures. I should play the lottery, because having these guys be a part of the USFL project is an absolute blessing.
And it was sort of totally unintentional for you to get to this point. You were just doing it to try to collect some helmets with some autographs on it. That's amazing.
I would, if you would have told me that I would have had 100 people on that page in 10 years, I would have laughed in your face. I did not think there was 100 people out there that cared about some guy in Texas who had a mini helmet collection, who had some signatures on these 19 or 20 helmets, which again ended up being a lot more. But if you would have told me I'd have had 100 people that were interested in the USFL, I would have said there's no way. And now we've got over 4,000 in that group, and we've got a lot of active members.
Wow. So what's your favorite helmet that you have in your collection from the USFL?
Well, you know, I've got to show my bias here. Again, I grew up in small town Oklahoma. So when they announced for the 84 season that Oklahoma was getting a franchise, mean, it had to be the Oklahoma Outlaws. The Oklahoma Outlaws had the best helmet in the USFL. And I know there's probably a lot of USFL alumni that are going to listen to this podcast, and I'm going to get a lot of grief from a lot of Philadelphia Stars, from a lot of Michigan Panthers, from a lot of Oakland Invaders, from a lot of teams. But if you're asking me personally, the Oklahoma Outlaws had the best helmet, bar none, from the USFL.
Interesting. So whose autograph did you get from the Outlaws on your helmet?
Oh, Doug Williams. Doug Williams was the one that I had to have. He was the face of the franchise. We only had the franchise for a year, but he was the face of the franchise. There was no way that it was going to be anybody else but Doug Williams. No disrespect to any other Oklahoma Outlaws, but it was Doug Williams or bust.
So how many helmets do you have right now in your collection of the USFL?
Hundreds.
Wow.
And I will leave it at that, because not only did I get into the mini helmet collecting, but I also found a company several years back that made the full size helmets. And I got into those too. And I probably have about 10 of those.
Wow.
And I mean, and you know, it goes across the board. There's a lot of people, and I did get a lot of flack from some people because there's a lot of big name players that had something to do with the USFL, whether they were drafted, whether they actually signed contracts, whether they had future contracts. And I went after all of any of them I can get. I can remember. I don't know why this name, because they're, no offense to this guy, but there are so many other big names that didn't actually play in the USFL that I got on mini helmets. But for some reason, when I got Irving Fryer on one of the mini helmets, I got so many comments from people going, Irving Fryer never played in the USFL. And, you know, of course, in my mind, I'm going, if you had read the description, you would know that I said he was a draft pick of this certain team. But, you know, the internet's a fickle thing. So sometimes people don't read. Sometimes people just react.
I hear you. Well, let's get into a little bit of the history of the USFL, and you know, maybe we can find what that magic is that everybody's so excited about, you know, some 30 years later. Now, I believe it sort of started as a plan of somebody that was involved in the NFL, and maybe you could go into that a little bit.
So the plan originated from David Dixon, and David Dixon has a pretty rich history in the NFL. He was also a very, very successful businessman. The start of the USFL didn't happen when people actually think. The Dixon plan goes back to the 60s. David Dixon had an agreement with the Raiders to buy them, and he was going to move them to New Orleans. And then the New Orleans mayor stepped in and said, no, that's not going to happen. We're keeping our team here. So I don't know, because I've unfortunately, never got the chance to speak to Mr. Dixon. I don't know if he already had this plan in place, but there are documents out there and even newspaper articles that the USFL was going to open in the early to mid 60s. He had that plan back then, and he was going to unleash the United States Football League as a spring league back in the 60s. So the NFL, of course, catches wind of that. And this is just me speaking. So I'm speaking to what I think. The NFL catches wind of this. They go to David Dixon and say, hey, we are putting a franchise in New Orleans if we want you to be a part of it. And so David Dixon became a very, very, very big part of the New Orleans Saints joining the NFL. And he, from start to upbringing, David Dixon was a huge part of the New Orleans Saints. So for all the New Orleans Saints fans out there, if you want somebody to thank for having your franchise, it's David Dixon and nobody else. And New Orleans has been a great city for the NFL. I mean, you know, from the Saints' struggles early on to their Super Bowl win to the Super Bowls they've hosted, I mean, New Orleans has been fantastic. And you can see that as part of the USFL, because when the New Orleans Breakers were there, they had great attendance. People wanted to go see football. I mean, it's unfortunate that they had to move from Boston, which is a great football city, but they moved to New Orleans And the fans embraced the Breakers, took them in, and made them their own. And that's what's even more heartbreaking is unfortunately the ownership couldn't get it together, and they had to move the franchise again to Portland, which, by the way, is a little piece of football history. There, to my knowledge, and if anybody out there wants to call in or write in, write to Darren, but. But I believe the Breakers franchise is the only franchise in professional football history that has moved three consecutive years and kept the team name the same. They were the Boston Breakers, they were the New Orleans Breakers, and they were the Portland Breakers. I don't think that's ever happened.
Interesting. If you want to email me, go ahead, pigskindispatch@gmail.com, and we'll forward it on to Kyle if you have something different. So we'll make sure we get that information to him. Okay, now... So Dixon is gets involved with the New Orleans Saints back in the mid 60s. So how does his idea in the mid 60s come to light in the early to mid 80s?
David Dixon was a very smart man, and he knew that there was a need for more football, and he knew that there was a huge, huge gap. You've got college football playing in the fall. You've got the NFL playing in the fall. You've got no spring football. You've got nothing. So these football fans, they gear everything toward the end of the year. And then once February comes, the Super Bowl's over, then you're in the 80s. There's no internet. There's no apps. There's no anything. So now the football news just dies. You might get, you might get a contract extension signing on the 10 o'clock news, or you might get this or you might get that, but it just dies. And he knew that there were rabid fans out there that wanted more. And that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to create a successful business venture, and he wanted to give the fans what they wanted. And he had the perfect plan. I mean, I hate to say that because we all know nothing's perfect, but he had the near perfect plan. And spring football would have worked had the owners followed the plan.
Okay, let's get into that a little bit, because let's talk about year one. Now, when did they play? Did it end up being a spring league, or did it end up being in the fall?
Yeah, it started in February 1983.
So they right after the Super Bowl, they kick off and they start their season. So the fans are still excited about football. They got something new. They're watching it. And how'd that first year go with the USFL?
Well, the brilliance of David Dixon and the league, the information that he gave the league, is that the first season, they didn't do any preseason games. So there was no preview of the USFL. Now, if you were in one of the cities, if you were in Philadelphia, or you were in Detroit, you might have been watching progress in your local newspaper, and they might have covered it on the news. But there was no preview. I bring it back to this. One of my favorite films is Jaws. I love Jaws. And in my adulthood, I've actually watched the documentary about Jaws. And you heard about all the problems with the shark. I mean, if you listen to Richard Dreyfuss, one of the funniest things Richard Dreyfuss says is he said, on the island, we're a month behind schedule, and everybody has these walkie-talkies, and constantly you would hear, the shark is not working. And you would hear it on the radios the whole time. So then when the shark finally pops out of the water at Roy Scheider, it was the first time that the shark worked correctly, and they were so excited about it, they left that scene in the movie because they got the shark to work properly. They got the full expression of Roy Scheider's face. They did it by accident. Well, David Dixon didn't do that by accident. He did this by plan. He did not do any preseason games because he wanted that opening week to punch everybody in the face. He wanted every eye that he could possibly get on the TV. So he absolutely got it. He gave people football in the spring, and they had never had it
before. We know a lot of stars ended up going to the USFL, but did they have the big names that first year, or was it basically a bunch of guys that did not make the NFL?
Oh no, they had huge names the first year. I mean, they had Chuck Fusina, they had Kelvin Bryant, they had Anthony Carter, they had Derek Holloway, they had John Corker. I mean, they had big names throughout the USFL. And, you know, another thing that I want to just talk about, and I am not a hater of the NFL. I enjoy the NFL product, but there's been a lot of talk about how the NFL is expanding to a 17 game schedule this year. Mm-hmm. And as I appreciate that, and I watch the NFL pat themselves on the back, I want to point out that for three seasons, the USFL had an 18 game schedule with no bye weeks.
Wow.
No bye weeks. So yeah, the first year you only had 12 teams, but that's 18 game. Think about the Michigan Panthers and the Philadelphia Stars in that first season. They had 18 straight games. Then they roll into the playoffs. Then they roll into the championship game and they get no breaks. So as much as I appreciate the 17 game schedule with the bye weeks, the NFL's got a lot of catching up to do.
Sure. The NFLPA thinks it's too much right now. So that's interesting. I didn't realize they played 18 game seasons. It's neat. Okay. Now, so they play spring ball that first season. What about season number two? What's going on with the USFL?
So the numbers from season one were great. And that was part of the problem. Was already in 1983, the owners were not following the Dixon plan. They were spending and spending and spending. And you can look at several owners. A lot of people like to talk about one certain owner in the USFL that's a real hot button. But you can look at a couple of different owners and see that they opened their checkbooks because they wanted that first USFL title. They wanted that talent. And so the problem between 83 and 84, in my opinion, simply was expansion. They went from 12 to 18 teams from 83 to 84. So your first season, you just had a successful first season and you expand to six more teams, that it's unheard of. And, you know, they put teams in good markets, not necessarily great markets, but good markets. But the overexpansion in 84, that's part of what led to the downfall of the USFL.
Okay. Now, were they still a spring league that second season, or is that when they switched to the fall?
They were a spring league throughout. They were talking about moving to the fall in the 86 season.
Okay. Okay.
And what's funny, you mentioned that a couple of the artifacts that I have that I really enjoy. I actually have a 1986 Baltimore Stars pocket schedule and a 1986 Memphis Showboats pocket schedule. So they had the schedule laid out to play in 86, but then the lawsuit happened.
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit. Now, what exactly was the lawsuit, and what was who initiated it, and what was sort of its purpose?
Well, the lawsuit was about monopoly, that the NFL was trying to monopolize football, and especially fall football. And I think it was more of a last-ditch effort to get the NFL to possibly settle, because there were several teams that were in financial trouble, and maybe even the league itself. You know, that's something that we can explore later on. But the lawsuit was basically that the NFL was a monopoly on football, and especially fall football.
Now, when exactly? I mean, in the time frame of the league. Okay, we're in season two. Is that when the lawsuit came out, or was that more in season three?
The lawsuit was more season three. That was more in the 85 season. And you could even, when you watch some of the broadcasts from the playoff games and especially the championship game, you can kind of tell that the announcers, the media, they did not expect the USFL to come back for the 86 season. I mean, I think everybody but the USFL knew that they were done. And then, of course, you know, 86 happens, there's no football, and then and then 87 is finally when the USFL officially folded.
Let's go back to that second season, because I'm sorry, I just had you maybe think of another question. Okay, so they actually increased their teams by, 150% from season one to season two. Now, how did season two go? You said it was pretty good season one. You know, they had 18 games. They got through it, had their championship game, the playoffs. Everybody's feeling pretty good about it. What happened in season two?
Season two, to the casual fan, looked good. I mean, they were still bringing in good numbers, not great numbers, but good numbers. But behind the scenes, it was more a little bit more chaotic. There were a lot of owners, and you can read and find videos about this in quite a few places. But in season two, there was a lot of chaos behind the scenes. There was a lot of team owners that may or may not have been paying their bills, may or may not have been paying players. There was just a lot of financial issues behind the scenes in 84. Now, for the casual fan, again, if you were watching on TV and you were watching, you know, ABC's This Is the NFL or this is the USFL, or, you know, you were reading reports, you probably weren't hearing a whole lot about this. You have to really do deep dives to see the media coverage that was actually telling what was happening. And that's a lot of newspapers, because the TV wasn't going to bury the USFL because they had a contract with ABC.
We have 18 teams. I assume they all finished that second season. And what happens going into season three?
Chaos. A couple of the franchises from 84 folded. The Washington franchise that had been in D.C., the Washington Federals, that had been there from 83 and 84, they had big plans, and they were going to move to Miami, and they were going to be the Spirit of Miami. And then that deal fell through, so they had to go to Orlando and become the Orlando Renegades. That being said, they had also negotiated a deal for Howard Schnellenberger to become the coach. And he was a big time. I mean, University of Miami football in 1984, 1985, big, mm-hmm. big. And Howard Schnellenberger was going to go and be the coach of the Spirit of Miami. Well, when the move to Miami went Dixie, so did Schnellenberger. He went, thanks, but no thanks. And so he goes back to Miami. The team moves to Orlando. They still struggle. And it's unfortunate, because the Orlando Renegades actually had a really good roster. They had kind of an aging quarterback, but still very good, in Reggie Collier. But, you know, Orlando just never really survived that whole. I mean, they had Lee Corso as their coach.
But
they never survived that. We're moving to Miami. Oh, wait. No, you guys are going to take a detour and go to Orlando. That just set the tone for the Renegades that year.
Okay. How many teams did the USFL have in that third season?
In the last season in 1985, they actually condensed the whole thing, and they condensed it to two conferences, the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference, because before they had not only conferences, but they had all these divisions. So you can obviously see that the USFL was kind of backing off of the success that they had had before. So in 1985, they went back to 14 teams, which is only two more teams than what they had in the inaugural season.
Okay. So they basically dropped four teams from season two to season three then. Okay.
Including my beloved Oklahoma Outlaws. So I got one season with the Oklahoma Outlaws, and then they left me and went to Arizona and merged. The Oklahoma Outlaws actually merged with the Arizona Wranglers. So they became the Arizona Outlaws. So I didn't technically lose them. I lost them out of the state, but I didn't lose the team. But I also didn't follow the Arizona Outlaws probably as closely as I should have.
Gotcha. You talked a little bit about at the beginning of this interview that the And that the USFL had some former NFL players in it to start off with. What are some of those names that they were able to draw the NFL to start their league off?
Oh, there are a ton of different names that were involved with the USFL. I mean, you start at the top. I had this question asked to me the other day about the Mount Rushmore of USFL. And when you start like that, you start with Herschel Walker. I mean, Herschel Walker was the big name that came into the USFL, but you had so many guys. I mean, I was thinking about the 83 season the other day and a couple of the marquee games. And it was so funny to me because I actually revisited one of the games, but the Arizona Wranglers in 83, they had Greg Landry as their quarterback, and he was a pretty big deal in Detroit with the Lions, and he was mm-hmm. a good quarterback. And one of the most memorable games from 83, Greg Landry gets hurt, and no offense to the guy, but this guy that really nobody really knew comes in and puts in one of the best performances of 1983 season. And that's what the USFL was all about. They had these big NFL names that were a part of the USFL, but they also had these guys that came in that nobody really knew. And everybody's going, hey, who is this guy? This guy's good. Who is this guy? And then, the research, because again, you don't have the internet. You've got to go to the library and, get on the fish system and take a look at, newspapers and stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't at your fingertips like it is, nowadays.
Yeah. So basically they had a pretty decent plan where they pulled some NFL veterans out that were misplaced, I guess. And they were able to grab a hold of them. I mean, I think like Brian Sipe, you talked about Doug Williams, some big names in the NFL that were maybe near the end of their career or just ready for a change and end up going to USFL. And then they got into those draft picks and really that early mid 80s drafts were for the NFL and the USFL were sort of a mixed breed, almost the likes that hadn't been seen since the AFL had been around before the merger. You talked about Herschel Walker. How about some of the other, the big names that came out of college and went right to the USFL?
Well, there were quite a few. I mean, the one that comes to mind is Reggie White. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the funny thing is, Reggie White ends up going to Memphis. So he's in his backyard basically, but Reggie White was a huge draft pick that nobody really thought that was a big, big draft pick. But I can tell you from talking to someone that was in the Memphis Showboats administration at the time, Reggie White was a huge get. And then to turn around and add John Corker, who was a monster with the Michigan Panthers. I mean, you had two of the best defensive ends in the game on the same team. And then you look at the entire 85 Memphis Showboats defense. They were incredible. I mean, all kinds of star power. So, the draft was amazing, but the thing is with the draft is that there were some guys drafted that never even thought about going to the USFL. I mean, you got Eric Dickerson, Dan Marino. I mean, you've got all kinds of names that go along with the USFL draft. That now, the interesting thing about Marino is that Marino actually talked contract with the LA Express, which is very strange knowing that the LA Express's marquee quarterback ended up being Steve Young. But Dan Marino actually did a little bit of press with the LA Express before he decided to enter into the NFL draft. And that's actually documented.
I did not know that. Yeah, but you had some of those quarterbacks, like Jim Kelly, Steve Young, like you mentioned, Mike Rozier, Doug Flutie, Sam Mills, we talked about the other night on one of my other programs, just some great players that started off there getting their feet wet in professional football with the USFL and really went on to some great things in that league and in the NFL later on.
Sam Mills is the epitome of the USFL. Let me tell you why. He went to a small college. He was a small guy. He wasn't given a chance to play football. And Sam Mills persevered. And Jim Mora took one look at Sam Mills and said, I want that guy on my team. I want that guy to be a part of my team. And what did Sam Mills do? He led Philadelphia. He led Baltimore. He was a team leader. He was a leader in statistics. He went on to the NFL. He had a great career. And that's why we say keep pounding. So I will stick my flag in the ground right now. Now that Drew Pearson is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and let me emphasize Pro Football Hall of Fame, Sam Mills is the biggest discrepancy in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, bar none. You throw me any other name, and I will dispute you till the end of time. Sam Mills should have been in the Pro Football Hall of Fame 10 years ago. And it's a travesty that the Pro Football Hall of Fame continues to overlook Sam Mills as a Hall of Famer, because he absolutely was. And let me say something else. And this is something that I haven't said very often. And I really, really, really respect this gentleman, not only as a football player, but as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a grandfather. I really do respect him. But I'm going to say this on this program right now. Jim Kelly does not get in the Pro Football Hall of Fame unless they recognize his statistics from the USFL. And I don't know why Sam Mills doesn't get the same consideration.
Why do you think that is? Okay, like you said, it is the Pro Football Hall of Fame. It's not the NFL Hall of Fame. It's not the AFL Hall of Fame. But why do you think that is, that the Pro Football Hall of Fame doesn't recognize the statistics from, the World Football League and the USFL and even the CFL? They're all professional football leagues. Why do you think that is?
My opinion is that the NFL pulls every string that has to do with the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And the NFL does not want to acknowledge the USFL. The NFL does not want to acknowledge the CFL. And I know this is going to sound kind of silly, but when we're talking pro football, the Pro Football Hall of Fame should consider XFL Season 1. They should consider the World Football League. They should consider the Continental Football League. They should consider all of these pro leagues, and they don't, because they've got a multi-billion dollar company that they have to feed everybody involved. So they don't want to involve anybody that showed them any type of competition. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not the Pro Football Hall of Fame. It's the NFL Hall of Fame. And to be quite honest, with a few of the guys that have gotten into the Hall of Fame in these past few years, I think they should probably consider changing the name to the Hall of Very Good. Because some of these guys that they have actually put in the Hall of Fame, I don't think they're actually Hall of Famers. And I'm not going to get into any names. I don't want to get into that part of the controversy, but it's become the NFL Hall of Very Good.
Let's backtrack here a little bit and get to sort of, what do you think are the some of the reasons of the demise of the USFL? Why didn't it stick around? Dixon had a pretty solid plan. Why do you think it's still not with us today?
I think you hit the nail on the head. The problem was, at the outset, the owners decided that, hey, we've got professional football franchises right now. We don't need to follow the Dixon plan. He got us here and we appreciate it. It's kind of the old saying, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So Dixon got him there and showed him what they needed to do. And they decided to go a totally different route. I mean, a lot of these owners were leaders in their industry. So you're talking about you're talking about a lot of ego, a lot of ego. And, you know, you stop following the Dixon plan from day one, and nobody's there to go, hey, man, we need to rein you in because you can't be spending that type of money. These guys, they didn't care about it. They were building shopping malls. They were financial geniuses. They didn't. Don't tell me I can't spend my money, because I can spend my money, because I've spent my money to a point where I can buy a professional football franchise. So I appreciate your opinion, but let me handle this. And they did, and there was nobody there to pull the reins on these guys. And then you bring in an owner in 1984, and this is always a hot button in the USFL project, and we can get into this at the very end. But one of the things we don't do in the USFL project is we don't talk politics. And you will see that in the way that I describe this next thing. When Donald Trump decided to come in and own the New Jersey Generals, he wanted, in my opinion, he wanted to make that a bridge to owning an NFL team. It was no secret that he wanted to be an owner in the NFL. And probably if you gave him truth serum, he probably still does. But at this point in 1984, he bought into the USFL because he wanted to work his way into the NFL. And so, you know, you've got this larger than life figure. I mean, he was big in the 80s. Say what you want about the guy, but he was successful. You know, there are a lot of people that go, oh, what about the bankruptcies? Oh, what about this? In my opinion, and I'm not defending the guy at all, but if you've got the money to bankrupt a company and come out smelling like a rose, then I mean, I'm sorry, but that's part of finances. I mean, there's just some things that don't work, and you cut your ties with them, and you move on. And that's what he did.
Now, and what do you think about this? There's some theories that I've heard thrown around throughout the years that, you know, because there was two or three of the franchises, even at the end, were making money. And there was two or three franchises that were having attendance that were, you know, 40 to 55,000 people average attendance. So they were thriving. There's probably, so let's say there's five of those franchises. The theory is that I've heard is those, some of those owners of those franchises were hoping that maybe it was ripe for the NFL at the time had 28 teams. They were hoping it was ripe for the NFL to recognize, hey, there's a lot of talent here that could be spread around and maybe possibly merge, almost like the AFL and the AFC were merged in the NFL, you know, years earlier and decades earlier. What do you think about that theory?
I'm sure there were owners that thought that, but the USFL needed more history. I mean, you only had three seasons. If you go all the way to 85, you only had three seasons of history. But you know, for on some points, I agree with that, because I will tell you right now, there would be no Jacksonville Jaguars without the Jacksonville Bulls. The Jacksonville Bulls were at the top of the attendance every single year in the USFL. The Jacksonville fans, they wanted pro football, and it didn't take 10 years for the NFL to recognize that, because Jacksonville Bulls were there till the very end. And when everything went south in 85, the NFL was right there sniffing around going, hey, this might work. And so 10 years later in 95, surprise, the NFL puts a expansion team in Jacksonville. And I'll say a little bit more to a smaller point is I think the USFL helped the Carolina Panthers as well. And Carolina came in that same year, but the USFL had exhibition games in Carolina that were wildly successful. So I think the NFL took, I mean, I know the NFL was taking note of what the USFL was doing, because you all you have to do is look at the rule changes and the things that the NFL added after the USFL were gone. And they were like, oh, we're going to add this brand new thing, this challenge flag. Well, that's great. But the USFL was already doing that. Well, we're going to add the 2-point conversion being optional. Well, that's great. But the USFL already did that. I mean, the NFL took so much from the USFL. They not only took the league with the final lawsuit, but they took so much from the USFL, including players, coaches, everything else. I mean, God, go back to New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans became, all respect to Archie Manning, but New Orleans became actually palatable to watch when the USFL folded, because they went and got Jim Mora and they went and got Bobby Hebert. And that's when the Saints and Sam Mills and, you know, a couple of other guys, and the Saints were actually decent to watch. They were fun. But the NFL went and raided the USFL to make the Saints fun. The Saints were dogs. And I love New Orleans. Everybody that's listening from New Orleans right now, I love your city. I love your culture. I love everything about you guys. But the Saints weren't relevant until they cherry-picked everybody from the USFL. And all you have to do is look at the history to see that. And there are so many other cities that can say the exact same thing.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit now. Okay, you gave us a great outlook of how the sort of the USFL's history and some of their legacy things, you know, that have carried on, not only the players and coaches, but you know, the challenge flag and you know, some expansion cities in the NFL with Carolina and Jacksonville. Now let's talk a little bit about where do you see your group going from here with the USFL project? What's your plans do you have coming up in the near future?
We are constantly working behind the scenes. We have a lot of things that are happening that unfortunately I can't really get into too much in depth, but I will tell you that the USFL project has some lofty goals, and we've got a great team. I mentioned it before. I'm going to mention them again because I love these guys, Tom Cadle, Jim Parcells, Rob Butts. We've got a great team at the USFL project. We are working day and night to build the USFL project into something more. And I can promise you, when I say something more, I'm not talking about we're going to have our own website. We're going to have our own app. We're going to have our own this. I'm not talking about basic things. We've got some big, huge, lofty goals that we continue to work on day after day after day. And, you know, all of us have day jobs. And when we find we work on the USFL project while we're working on our daily stuff, and then we work on it into the evening. That's why I'm here with you tonight. I mean, I wanted to be a part of this show. I wanted to talk about the USFL, and I want to talk about as much as I can about the USFL project. And that's why we do what we do, because we love the USFL. And at some point, and I hate to even think about this, but at some point, some talking head on some sports network is going to come along and say, the last player, executive, coach, cheerleader, whatever it might be, the last person involved with the USFL project, or the USFL, sorry, the USFL has passed away. And at that point, it's really up to us to have everything in line to be going forward in what we're doing, and to keep the USFL alive for all of the alumni, for all of the players that sacrificed their bodies, for all of the front office executives who didn't get home until late and their family was asleep and they didn't get to kiss their kids goodnight, to all of the cheerleaders, who stayed after and signed autographs and took pictures to the ball boys that had, you know, people constantly going, hey, can I get this? Hey, can I get that? All these people, that's what we care about. We want to take everyone that had a part in the USFL, and we want to make sure that it continues forever and ever and ever. Way past me, way past the team. I mean, I have a daughter. I hope at some point she takes an interest in it, and I hope she's a part of it. She continues it. But what we're doing right now is something probably bigger than anybody's ever seen.
Well, that's great. Now, what if some of the listeners here would like to become either follow or join the USFL project? How do you have some social media call signs that you can give us that they can join you and at least follow you?
We do. Actually, the best way to be a part of the USFL project at this point is to go to Facebook and go to Facebook groups and search for the USFL project. Now, let me tell you, and I want to be very clear about this, we ask you 3 questions to join the group. We don't want the Russian bots. We don't want the people, you know, selling something or whatever. So we ask 3 questions to get in the group. We ask you, who is your favorite team? We ask you if you were a fan or alumni. And we ask you if you agree to the rules, because we have 10 rules. Again, I mentioned we don't talk politics. There's 9 other simple rules, very, very basic, but we had to create them. If you didn't have a favorite team, just say, I didn't have a favorite team, or say, I was too young for the USFL, or I watched all the teams. You can answer that question however you want. And the fan or alumni, we only ask that because we want to make sure that we identify our alumni so that we can, you know, make sure that we're in contact with them should anything arise. You know, should there be a reunion of a certain team or anything. We just want to know if you're a fan or alumni. And the rules are simple. I mean, the rule that we have the most problem with is, of course, no politics. And that goes back to the general's owner. And then the second rule that we have problems with is every post has to be USFL related. That's all we ask. It's that simple. And we have so many great contributors that find these articles that, you know, it's a USFL alumni who's now gone on to be a coach or a high school principal or a successful businessman. We have so many great contributors that are a part of the USFL project. So that the USFL project on Facebook groups is absolutely the best place to connect with us. We are also on Twitter at the USFL project. We are on Instagram at the USFL project. So any way you want to connect with us, we're happy to connect with us. You know, we're happy that you want to connect with us, and we try to be interactive. If you ask a question about the USFL, we try to get back to you as quick as we possibly can. You know, if you want to contact me directly, you know, I'm happy to do that. My email is intheminors@gmail.com. You can contact me directly if you're an alumni, if you were a fan, if you are. And that's one of the amazing things. Let me tell you a quick story. And I know we're running out of time, and I don't want to stretch my welcome. But one of the most beloved owners in the USFL was John Bassett with the Tampa Bay Bandits. Everybody loved John Bassett. He was fun. He was passionate. He put a great product on the field. John Bassett was so great. And I think about a year, maybe 2 years ago, because John Bassett actually passed away shortly after the USFL. But a year or two ago, his son joined the group, and he was very kind and very humble. And he was like, I really appreciate you guys, you know, keeping the history of the USFL alive. And it was humbling for me, because I'm looking at this guy making comments in our group, and it's John Bassett. And I'm like, this kid was on the sidelines. He was on the team. for the Tampa Bay Bandits. And he's thanking us. And I'm like, no, don't thank us. We want to thank you. This is why we do this. We do this because we want you guys, every single one of you guys, to be remembered. So it was just one of those moments where you go, God, that's just surreal.
Well, that is definitely a cool story. And I mean, what you folks are doing there is a great thing, you know, preservation of football history in any form, level, country. That's what we're all about. That's what we want to do, is preserve the gridiron history. And we appreciate you taking the time this evening to share that USFL history and, you know, give our listeners a great glimpse of the USFL and what it was all about and the passion that you show for it. I'm sure showed by the rest of the 4,000 in your group. And hopefully you'll get some new people that have joined that group tonight by your appearing here. So we appreciate your time, sir, and we'll look for you on social media and for things to come. So thank you very much, Kyle.
Hey, thank you for having me. And again, thank you to all the listeners. I truly appreciate this podcast. I'm glad you guys took the time to listen to me. And hopefully I'll be back and we can maybe break a little bit of news about the USFL project.
Okay. If you got some news, make sure you let us know and we'll get you right on, because we're on daily. So that's great. So Kyle Smith of the USFL Project, thank you once again. And we'll hope to be seeing some great things from you and the USFL Project coming very soon.
Thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.